Welcome to the podcast of this Brecan information session. Information sessions are recorded at the Brecan Resource Centre and can be borrowed in CD format from the Resource Library. Sessions are copyrighted and are for personal home use only. If you would like to know more about this and other sessions, please contact Brecan on 1300 781 500. We hope you enjoy this podcast.
Welcome to Volume 77 in the Brecan What's On Information Sessions, a series of talks produced for people with gynecological or breast cancer, their families and friends. This session was recorded on the 7th of May 2012 at the Brecan Resource Centre in the Queen Victoria Women's Centre, located in Melbourne's CBD. Justine Diggins is a clinical psychologist from Peter Mac, and in this session she talks about what contributes to sleep problems, what happens when we are sleep deprived, cancer-specific factors that contribute to sleep loss, and some strategies to get that good night's sleep. We hope you enjoy this session.
You've already heard a little bit about who I am. I've been working at the Peter Mac for about 6 years or so, and my main job there as a clinical psychologist is to work with the patients of Peter Mac. So I work across all different types of cancers. Quite a bulk of the people that come to our service are women with breast or other gynecological cancers, and many of whom do report sleep problems. So it is a big issue, and I'm hoping today that maybe a little bit of what I talk about is of interest to you and might give you some practical ideas about how to try and improve a little bit your own sleep and any sleep problems you might have had. Now, where do I point this to? Okay.
That's all right. The remote, it goes forward. At the laptop.
That's all right.
Something else. How about I?
There's always something that goes wrong, isn't there? Are you able to do that through? Okay, perfect. I'll just give you a look every time. Okay. So just to give you a sense of what I will be talking about through this, because you might be wanting to jump in with some answers which will come later on in the presentation. First I'll just talk a little bit about what is sleep, and it can be helpful to understand what is sleep, how we sleep, etc., in knowing then how you can possibly change or influence your sleep. Second, I'll talk a little bit about the common sleep problems that people face. Thirdly, issues specific to people who have cancer. And then fourthly, what you can do to actually try and improve your sleep. So first of all, what is sleep? Well, all creatures need to sleep, all animals, all humans, we need to sleep. We're not still 100% sure exactly why we need to sleep, but we do need to sleep. there are some things we know and some things that we still don't know exactly. So, for example, we do know that sleep allows our bodies to repair and replenish energy, which of course we need to function each day. But we can get a lot of repair and resting by simply... we can replenish our energy by simply resting. So lying down and actually not doing anything, putting your feet up, quite literally, can actually restore our energy levels quite a bit. So sleep doesn't explain entirely why we need to actually go to sleep to get this. Sleep, however, we do know also is very important in allowing us to process and sort out information, to also consolidate memories and learning. So these are the things that we do know about sleep. We just don't know exactly why we need it so significantly as we do, I guess, and why it works the exact way it does. But I'll talk you through the ins and outs of that in a moment. Thanks, Kelly. You can move to the next one. So there are five stages of sleep. The first stage is light sleep. The second stage is stage two, where our body temperature and our heart rate starts to drop. Stage three and four are really important. These are where we get our deep and restorative sleep. And what happens is our brain waves will actually change, our muscles will relax, and we'll become very, almost paralysed. We're in a really deep state of muscular and mental relaxation. The fifth stage is REM sleep, which I'm sure you've all heard about. This is quite different to the other stages of sleep, and this is the stage of sleep where we have rapid eye movement and where we dream. And this is probably one of the more mysterious and intriguing aspects of sleep, because we don't really know why we need this so much, but we REM sleep is extremely important, we do know that. Now this is a graph showing the typical cycles through the different stages of sleep. So this you can see the awake bit, and then stages 1, 2, 3 and 4, and then the black columns are REM sleep. And across the bottom we have hours of sleep. So what you'll see from here is in the first hour of sleep, you first go into stage 1 and then stage 2 and then stage 3 and then stage 4, and then you actually cycle back out to stage 3 and then stage 2, and then you go into REM sleep. And then you cycle back down to the restorative sleep again, and then back up again into REM sleep. And you continue to do that through the night. But as you'll notice, the deep sleep, the stages 3 and 4, more of it happens at the beginning of your rest. Okay, and you can see that you only dip into stage 3 and stage 4 very briefly and for short amounts of time later on at night, assuming that you sleep overnight. As of course, shift workers might sleep during the daytime. But REM sleep also, you might notice, becomes bigger. So we have more stage 3 and 4 sleep at the beginning, less REM sleep, and towards the end of your sleep you have less stage 3 and 4 sleep and more REM sleep. So this is probably why we wake up in the morning and we remember our dreams. And you might, if you wake up an hour after you go to sleep, you might not, because you might be in a completely different stage and not in the REM sleep hello. The main stages that are very important for us are the restorative sleep, so stages 3 and 4, as well as REM sleep. And as I mentioned just before, most of the restorative sleep occurs in the first couple of hours, the first 3 or 4 hours. So most of the REM sleep occurs in the last 3 to 4 hours. So sometimes, some people survive on very few hours sleep, and these are people who are getting a lot of their deep and restorative sleep at the beginning, and we can actually function okay, not brilliantly, but okay if we get sort of 3 or 4 hours sleep each night. So what controls our sleep-wake cycle? Obviously, most people are awake during the daytime and most people sleep overnight. If you're a shift worker or for other reasons, you might have a slightly different sleep-wake cycle. But most of us will be awake for a large period of the day and asleep for around 8 hours at night time. So how come we do this, and what regulates our sleep-wake? First of all, there's the circadian rhythm. You might have heard of this. This is actually a biological clock inside of us that tells us that we have a 24-hour cycle, and at some point we want in that cycle to have about 8 hours of sleep. So that is a biologically driven cycle. However, it is influenced by external cues such as night and daytime. So when we fly overseas to Europe, for example, our circadian rhythms can actually change, partly because the night and day cues are different, partly because you might forcibly stay awake or try and go to sleep, and it can adjust to that. We also are influenced by sleep-wake homeostasis, which are body signals that tell us when we need to sleep. And these are actually really important, because otherwise we might not sleep at all. So it's a bit like hunger. When we're hungry, our body is telling us that we need to eat. When we're tired, our body is telling us that we need to sleep. And these are really important in keeping the circadian rhythm going and keeping our cycle of wake and sleep regular. There are other rhythms of the body, and a lot of people don't know about the ultradian rhythms, but they can be quite useful to know about if you're having sleep problems. So, for example, these are biological cycles that occur multiple times during the day, and they refer to a range of different cycles during the day, including sleep. So sleep is just one of the ultradian rhythms that we have. And in sleep, these rhythms in our bodies go on about a 90-minute cycle. So we can see that most clearly actually when we are sleeping itself. Your REM sleep occurs about every 90 minutes. So the typical kind of dipping down and through the stages of sleep, coming up and then having a period of REM sleep, that usually takes approximately 90 minutes. And then the next cycle will begin and you'll go through the same again. When we're awake though, what that means for us is that we have periods of time that while we're still awake and most of the time we're alert, there might be moments across the day where you feel a little sleepier and tireder than usual. So a lot of people experience the after lunch kind of tiredness. Partly that's because you've been awake for a fair bit of the day and you've already done a lot of things. Partly it's often because you've had a big meal and your body is you know, concentrating on digesting food. So all of those things contribute as well, but it also will probably correspond with a bit of an ultradian dip, and you'll feel all those combined factors and you'll probably feel a bit sleepy. So we'll talk about how these become helpful when you're having sleep problems a bit later on in the presentation. So just a few things about sleep. Age and sleep. A lot of people aren't quite sure what is normal for people of different ages. So babies and children, most people know this, babies and children need much more sleep than adults do, and that is because they are developing so much, they are learning so much, they are you know, putting down all the sort of neuronal connections in their brains that they're while they develop. Adults, on average, need about 8 hours of sleep. A lot of people think that older adults need less sleep, and that's not entirely true. Obviously, people's lifestyles might change, so to some degree they might need less sleep than if you're not as physically active or as mentally active as you were. But if keep all of those factors about the same, and everyone needs around 8 hours sleep. However, older adults tend to have more sleep problems than younger adults do. So this is often why older people tend to sleep less, and we sort of have this perception that actually they might not need as much sleep, but they do, ideally. So other factors that affect sleep include genetics. Some people really do just fine on about 5 hours a night. Not me, and probably not the majority of people, but some people really do. Whereas other people, then the norm for them is about 10 hours, and you know that can be tough, you know, just getting 10 hours of sleep every night. So each of us we're just born differently, and each of us have sort of an ideal, and I'm sure you've probably all got a sense of what's your ideal amount of sleep. Physical activity, of course, affects sleep because that is energy out. And sleep is about how we reclaim energy. At the same time, physical activity also helps regulate sleep, though. So it can affect sleep in different ways. It can make us sleepy, it can make us tired, but it can also, if we do it in a regular and consistent way, exercise can also help regulate and improve sleep, too. Physical illness, obviously for a variety of reasons, being unwell can either make us sleep a lot more because our body needs more rest, or we don't have as much energy as we might have otherwise. Sometimes physical illness can make us not sleep, or it can cause difficulty sleeping, whether that's due to medications, whether that's due to the illness itself. So obviously it's a big factor that can affect sleep, and that's probably why I'm here today, because most people who have a diagnosis of cancer and go through treatment have gone through quite a lengthy period of physical illness and a lot of treatment and medication on top of that, and all of those things can contribute to sleep problems. Fourthly, stress and mental health problems, for example depression or anxiety disorders, whether it's a diagnosable problem, mental health problem, or whether it's just a sort of a normal ups and downs of coping with life, all of these things can contribute to causing and maintaining sleep problems. And we'll talk a bit more about this as well later. Thanks, Kelly. So what are the range of sleep problems and types of sleep problems that people face? Many people have difficulty falling asleep. So you might go to bed at 10 o'clock and 2 hours later you're still lying in bed and can't go to sleep, which is very frustrating. Some people have difficulty maintaining sleep, and that can be that you get to sleep and it might take you some time to get to sleep, or you might go to sleep really easily. But once you're asleep, you tend to wake again, maybe at 1 in the morning or 3 in the morning. And for some people they wake up and they can go back to sleep quite easily, but they keep waking up and it's disruptive. For other people, they wake in the middle of the night and then they can't get back to sleep again. And so, you know, you might spend another 2 or 3 hours lying there trying to get back to sleep. So a lot of people struggle with difficulties with maintaining sleep. The third common problem is early waking. So people who, you know, your sleep might be quite good, but you wake at 5 in the morning and that's it. You just can't get back to sleep. So you're only getting maybe 5 hours instead of your normal 8. And the fourth common problem is excessive daytime sleepiness, where you're just tired and your body is telling you, all of those hunger signals, tired signals are telling you you really want to sleep during the daytime. And to the point where it's above what's normal, above what we'd expect. So those are the types of problems, and so how frequently are these problems experienced by people in the community? In the general population, about 10 to 15% of people, if you take a cross-section at any point in time, 10 to 15% of people report sleep difficulties. In people who are newly diagnosed with cancer, about 30 to 50% report significant sleep difficulties. So there'll be people who already have problems, and then many others, 2 or 3 times that amount, will develop some kind of sleep problem following diagnosis of cancer. For people 5 years after their diagnosis with cancer, studies still report considerably higher numbers of people with sleep difficulties compared to the general population. So 23 to 44%. That's because different studies have slightly different criteria for what they determine to be a sleep problem. So this includes the range of results that different studies have. So that means that really, 1 in 4 to almost 1 in 2 people are really struggling 5 years after diagnosis. So this is quite a big problem. So if you're struggling with sleep, you're not alone. What happens when sleep deprived? I'm sure all of you could probably recount lots of stories of what happens. A lot can happen when we're tired. So the consequences of sleep loss and sleep deprivation, I'll talk you through them, but I should point out that most of these are quite temporary. They occur while you are lacking sleep. So if you catch up with your sleep, these tend to go away very quickly. However, if you have chronic problems with sleep, these might be chronic difficulties that you face as well. They include problems concentrating. So that might be that when you try and read a newspaper article or a book or do a crossword, or even when you have a conversation with someone, that your mind wanders, that you can't quite remember what you read, you have to reread a paragraph again, or you have to ask a person to repeat themselves. So that's because your concentration is easily distracted to other things. We have memory lapses and just poor memory. Usually it's short-term memory, so things like remembering exactly why you came to the supermarket, what you really needed to get for dinner, you probably forget 1 or 2 ingredients. Really common. Even forgetting people's names. You will remember it, but you remember it 5 minutes later, or you can't quite find the right word. These are all just temporary sort of memory lapses. Loss of energy, fatigue, and lethargy are all very, very common and probably quite understandable consequences of poor sleep. But some of the really difficult ones to deal with are down the bottom here. Emotional vulnerability. Sleep allows us, when we're feeling very refreshed and revived, good sleep allows us to manage our emotions. and we are emotional creatures. You might all have seen toddlers who are, you know, 1 or 2 years old, and they cry, and then they laugh, and then they giggle, and then they dance, and then they cry again. And, you know, this all happens within a 5-minute period. And we're actually, as adults, we're no different from children. Our emotions shift and change all the time. But we develop ways to manage that and to keep our emotional state and our emotional presentation a bit more stable to the world around us. And we're not quite as influenced by those emotions in a way that, for example, young children are. So when we are very tired, though, our capacity to manage our emotions is reduced. So we're much more easily tearful, we're much more easily irritated. You know, emotion, particularly the tougher emotions, they're just harder to keep on top of. And this, I think this can cause people distress if you're really just not yourself. And when you are in social situations or at work, for example, it can become a little more difficult to manage the ups and downs of life. Similar to that, I've got a point on lowered tolerance, which really, again, it comes down to the same thing, is you just don't have the same amount of energy to use your normal resources for coping with the challenges of life. And so for people who have been unwell or are unwell, that can mean that if you're in pain, that it's your tolerance and your capacity to tolerate that pain is much more reduced compared to normal. It means that if you're feeling unwell or you're in a position of discomfort, that it's a lot harder to manage that, and it's easier to feel a bit overwhelmed and brought down by those problems. My final point is when we lack sleep, again, this comes back to our cognition and our ability to mentally to do things. It's hard to think clearly. So it's harder to process information. We're usually a bit slower on processing things, and sometimes even making a decision, for example, what to cook for dinner, what to wear, whether to take your umbrella or not. Like, sometimes simple things can just feel too much. You know, your brain's just not able to cope with making ordinary decisions, and certainly big decisions become, you know, very tough to make. So again, if you're if your life involves making decisions on a daily basis, then being sleep deprived will become quite a problem. A lot of people ask about the relationship between sleep and the immune system. Obviously, people with cancer are very concerned about their immune system and keeping their immune system as healthy as possible. And a lot of people, particularly during treatment, are very concerned about, you know, keeping up a good immune system, and therefore become very concerned about not being able to sleep at a time when, of course, you know, their lives are very disrupted and they're probably very anxious. So I'll talk just a little bit about that. Sleep deprivation does impact the immune system. Studies have looked into this, and I don't understand it. This is on a biochemical kind of level that there are changes that they notice in people who are chronically sleep deprived. And I emphasise the point of chronically sleep deprived. We all have days or a week or two at a time where we don't sleep well. And I'm not sure of the effects there, but in terms of the impact on the immune system, I think we need to be sleep deprived for some time before there are any, you know, very significant impacts. But the question is exactly how much sleep deprivation is required to impact our immune system. We're not entirely sure. To what extent is the immune system affected when it does change? Like, are the changes okay? Maybe these changes don't indicate, you know, that there are going to be any problems in your immune system working when it needs to. But there are noticeable changes, but we're not quite sure exactly what they mean. Thirdly, we really don't know whether that has any significant effect at all on being diagnosed in the first place with cancer, so on a cancer coming about, on the treatment of cancer, or a person's recovery or survival of cancer. So a lot of people get very worried about the immune system, and I really understand that. Unfortunately, we don't have any really clear answers about how it might impact an individual. But however, I guess the point I want to make at the bottom, and I'll talk about this in a moment, is that it's really important to place sleep deprivation in its context, and that is that sleep loss is a really common experience for all human beings, for all populations. So that includes cancer populations and people who don't have cancer. It is a common part of life, just as stress is. So stress, often people think of stress as very negative and very bad, but stress is very, very similar to excitement. And we deliberately choose and seek out things that, that make us excited. We go on roller coasters, we book holidays for ourselves. And so stress is just a variation of that as well. It doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing. Boredom, you know, a lot of people complain of boredom is actually worse than being a little stressed. So stress is not bad for us. In the same way, a little bit of sleep loss, a little bit of sleep deprivation, we're geared to deal with these things. It's part of life, and our body is you know, it's capable of adjusting and managing these changes. Jet lag, for example, it can take up to a week, but you know, within a week, your body can completely flip its circadian rhythm on its head. So our bodies have this ability to adjust and adapt quite well. Secondly, the point that I really want to emphasise is, as I mentioned before, the effects of sleep deprivation tend to be temporary, very temporary, as in if you have one or two nights of good sleep, almost all of the effects of sleep deprivation will go away. So obviously for people who have chronic sleep problems, you might never actually get one or two good nights sleep in a row. But we it's not like if we're starved, we need to build up all of that food shortage that we've lost. With sleep, you can have, you know, 5 years of terrible sleep, and then you can have, say, three good nights in a row, and you'll be as good as gold. You know, obviously if someone has 5 years of bad sleep, it might be hard to get those three good nights of sleep. But our bodies really, you know, function, we recover from sleep loss very quickly. And that's important to know. So what causes sleep problems? A whole variety of things, and this is where if you've come here to try and get some answers or some help on your own sleep, this is where I start really paying attention, because the causes of sleep problems are usually multiple causes for any person. So you need to start thinking about each of these domains that I'm going to talk about in terms of how can you maximise each of these domains such that you maximise your sleep. The first is sleep routine. Some sleep problems are caused by a change in or simply, you know, poor sleep routine. And so sleep routine, what I mean is what time you go to bed, in what state you go to bed, whether that, you know, you've just gone to the gym and then you try to go to sleep immediately afterwards. So what your routine is before you go to bed and around bed. And when you wake up in the morning, what time you wake up. So your routine around sleep is very important in getting a good night's sleep. Some people watch television in their rooms, they tend to read before going to sleep, or you might end up having deeper meaningfuls with your partner before bedtime. You know, those things might make you more alert or more stimulated mentally and contribute to what I would call a challenging or a non-ideal sleep routine. All of those kind of things can affect your night's sleep. Poor diet and nutrition. There's no magical diet that makes sleep work. However, we do know that having a good, healthy, well-rounded diet does contribute to good sleep, and that if our nutrition and our diet is very poor or skewed, it also contributes to sleep problems. In particular, caffeine, so coffee, most people know this, coffee is a stimulant, and it can have an effect on your body for many, many hours after you have ingested caffeine. And obviously a stimulant is quite the opposite of what you want if you're trying to get to sleep. Smoking, similarly, has a stimulant effect, and alcohol Some people think alcohol is actually really good to help sleep.
Yeah.
It's good. It tends to help people get to sleep. Is that what happens?
That's what they say.
Some people like that little nightcap shot of whiskey. It does tend to make us sleepy, and therefore it possibly will make you go to sleep more easily. What it does, though, is it really messes with those stages of sleep and the REM sleep as well. So you'll get to sleep, but the quality of your sleep is quite badly affected by alcohol. Some people here may have experienced a hangover at some point in their lives. And if you have, there are lots of symptoms associated with hangovers. A lot of those symptoms are because of poor sleep, not actually because of the alcohol itself. But basically, you wake up feeling jet-lagged. You feel tired, you feel knocked around, you feel totally exhausted, and a large part of that is simply because the quality of your sleep has been terrible. And you might not have known it. You might have slept the whole time, but you're not getting those good stage 2, 3 and 4 stage sleep, nor the good quality REM sleep. So regular alcohol use, particularly just before bedtime, can impact your sleep quite a bit. Other factors, snoring, obviously, if you snore yourself, that can wake you up, or it can keep rousing you from and bumping you out of the good deep stages of sleep. If your partner snores, similarly that can wake you as well. Some people find that really vivid dreams, and certainly nightmares, can also have that effect of waking you up or just disturbing your sleep, because you're emotionally engaged in that dream or nightmare, and that can sometimes shift you and rouse you from your sleep as well. So again, if someone's going through a very stressful period in their lives or a period of great change, you might be having a sort of a richer dream life, and that might temporarily affect your sleep. Changes in body temperature. These are actually quite important, and I'm not sure that a lot of people really think about that. But at night time, our body temperature is meant to drop a little, and so we rug up and we kind of think that we're going to be the same temperature all night. But for a variety of reasons, that's not the case. Dreams can make us again respond in an emotional way, so your body temperature might rise because of the dreams that you're having. Obviously, with treatment for cancer, a lot of people experience hot flushes, which are extremely debilitating, so you go from normal temperature to very rapid, very hot state, so you're throwing blankets on and off. Being unwell can change your body temperature from lows to highs. Whether you sleep with a partner, whether you sleep with a cat or dog on your bed, all of these things can affect your body temperature and the temperature around you. And so if we're overly hot, we will wriggle and squirm, and we will come out of the deep sleep to allow our body to do that until we're more comfortable. So again, if your body temperature is changing throughout the night, or the room environment around you is changing throughout the night, then these things can contribute to your sleep problems. So what you wear to bed, what pyjamas, what nighties, what bed covers you have, and the temperature of the room, etc., all of these things can contribute in small ways, sometimes very significant ways, to your experience of sleep. My next point is on restless legs, and some people probably haven't heard of that, but there's something called restless leg syndrome, I've read that it's higher in people who have gone through cancer treatment, and I'm not quite sure why. I think it's something to do with sort of electrolyte balance, or something along those lines. I'm not entirely sure, but what it means is that it's a sudden jerking or twitching of your legs while asleep or while trying to get to sleep. And it's not uncommon, and people have it in the general population, people have it who have cancer, but it tends to wake people up. And as I said, we think that it's more common in people who have cancer, so you might notice that that you have this sudden jerking of the legs. Don't be too alarmed. We don't think that it's problematic, except that it wakes you up. Another major cause of sleep problems is excessive worry or excessive mental arousal or stimulation. So if you've got a lot on, and this can be, it can be very positive things that can be happening in your life, as well as very negative things. But if your brain is very wired and very active, then sleep is a lot harder, because of course sleep is when our brain should be resting and relaxing. So it's hard to sleep while having a very active mind. A final cause of sleep problems is when the bedroom is used for non-sleep activities. Part of our sleep routine and good sleep habits is that bed and the bedroom is about sleep. So when you walk into the bedroom, you feel good about it, you know what you're going to do, your brain immediately associates the bedroom with sleeping. So if you use the bedroom for working, you have a little office in your bedroom, or you take your laptop to the bed, or that's where you have all your family conversations with your partner about, you know, life in general, then you're kind of mixing the association. You know, the bed and the bedroom are about something different. In an ideal world, we want the bed to be about sleep and also sex, you know, loving your partner. But really beyond that, bed shouldn't be about watching television. It shouldn't be about doing homework or doing that assignment for work. It, you know, those things should be taken outside of the bedroom, so the bedroom and bed is about sleep. In terms of cancer-specific factors that we know really contribute to poor sleep, stress, worry and low mood. I'm sure you're all familiar with these. You know, there's virtually no one who doesn't feel stressed, who doesn't worry, who isn't significantly affected by a diagnosis of cancer. And so all of those things will increase, of course, your mental activity and your emotional state and make it harder to sleep. Illness, treatment and treatment side effects, also a very disruptive of good sleep. So people who are in pain, people who experience nausea, hot flushes, and a whole host of physical sort of symptoms, side effects, ailments that, you know, I don't need to tell you all about, of course can all affect sleep directly. Also, when people have a diagnosis or are going through treatment or post-treatment, changes in sleep routine or the sleep surroundings are very, very common. So all of a sudden you might need to get up in the morning at a different time, or you might be actually in hospitals for a portion of the time, or you might need to stay at someone else's house. All of those things can change your sleep. A fourth factor, which is another very important point to take on today, is that having unrealistic or unhelpful beliefs about sleep can contribute to very poor sleep. So for example, if you're trying to get to sleep and you're struggling and you're lying there thinking to yourself, I'm not getting enough sleep and this will impact my treatment, or this will impact my recovery, or I'm going to be so irritable tomorrow, I can't face anybody, you know, I just can't deal with people. If you're having thoughts along these lines, it's going to make you more stressed. It's going to not going to make you relaxed. It's not going to make you sleepy. It's going to make you more alert, more stimulated, and it's going to make sleep even harder. So it's really important to try and have a realistic understanding of sleep, which is why I've sort of spent some time going through what sleep is and how it works. We are very adaptable. Short-term sleep loss really wouldn't worry about it at all. So that's sort of having realistic beliefs and understandings of sleep and what's important and what our bodies are able to do, but also just unhelpful beliefs. Sometimes you might be exactly right, you know, that your sleep is going to cause you more problems tomorrow. So that's realistic. But is it helpful to focus on that thought? Is it more helpful to try and think about other things or to do something else mentally so you can get to sleep, so you can achieve that state of relaxation? So when you try and get to sleep, or when you're having trouble sleeping, just note what goes through your mind. What kind of thoughts do you have? A lot of people say they get very frustrated, and that's because of what they're thinking about. So just maybe there's a way of looking at those and changing those that will help you get to sleep. other cancer-specific factors that contribute to sleep problems. Cancer medications, steroids, for example, dexamethasone, prednisolone, hydrocortisone, are often used with chemotherapy and directly cause, can cause, again, it's very individual, but agitation, restlessness, irritability, low mood, or expansive mood, which is a, you know, slightly overly positive, or hunger. And all of these things can, you know, get in the way of sleep. Hormone treatment, another really big factor that can either directly or indirectly cause or contribute to sleep problems, through effects on mood, hot flushes, changes in body image, how you feel about yourself, your desire to engage in sexual relationships, you know, how you express yourself sexually, all of these change, so it changes relationship dynamics. These things will affect mood, will affect sleep. It's sort of a bit of a cyclical effect. Pain medications as well, another really big factor. Most of the time, if they're going to have an effect, it can make you drowsy. So it actually, they have, you know, they're sedatives. They can make you want to sleep more, which again can be a problem for many people. So the, one of the tricky things with sleep problems is that there's a bit of a vicious cycle, and I've kind of alluded to this already. What tends to happen is your sleep is disrupted, and then you experience distress over not being able to sleep. And again, that comes back to what kind of thoughts you have and what kind of an understanding you have of your sleep problems. You might be worried about the sleep problem itself, you might be worried about its impact on your treatment, on your recovery, etc. So now when you get to sleep, and going to sleep is associated with distress and frustration, then every time you go to sleep, you've now got an association of sleeping with distress and frustration. So now you have, again, you have an association that's not going to help with your sleep. So it's helpful to try and uncouple that. And of course, in turn, if you haven't had enough sleep, then, you know, it's harder to think clearly, it's harder to combat those dark thoughts. And we tend to engage in behaviours that don't help. You know, we tend to nap in the middle of the day, or we're tired so we don't eat as well. You know, or we resort to trying to, you know, bring the television in, or entertaining ourselves for the hours that you can't sleep. And in turn, those things actually contribute to worsening the problem rather than resolving it. So that's the vicious cycle. So on to then some of the sort of the strategies of what can you do to improve your sleep. I guess the main thing, I hope it's been clear from the slides previously, is there are many different factors that can contribute to any one person's problem with sleep. So first of all, work out what is your problem, you know. Is it getting to sleep? Is it staying asleep? Is it waking too early? Or is it daytime sleepiness? And then what are the variety of possible contributing factors that are affecting you? Because you're going to need to use a multi-pronged approach to resolving any sleep problem. Changing one thing is very unlikely to be enough to make a significant change. The other thing is, once you have a plan and you want to implement it, stick with it. It won't work overnight, and it probably won't work even after a week or two. All the research says that you really need to commit to 4 to 6 weeks before you'll even begin to notice any significant changes, which is kind of frustrating, isn't it? You know, it would be so nice if you could just tweak things a little bit and suddenly get that really good night's sleep. And this is one of the frustrating things about sleep, is that we are creatures of habit and routine. So when we change things a little bit, we need to let our bodies settle into that new habit, that new routine, and to let the body hopefully you know, use that and implement that. So trial something, give it a really good go, and if that doesn't work, then change your strategy and trial that and give it a really good go. But stick with your strategy as well. Don't start something and 2 days later change it, and then 2 days later change that again, because you won't know what's working and you won't know what isn't working. You really need to stick with something and give it a really good go for 4 to 6 weeks. The other thing I really recommend here is kind of documenting or keeping a diary of what you do and how it affects you. Often people say, I slept terribly. But we know that when you say to someone, well, how many hours didn't you sleep, or how long were you lying there awake for, that we're very poor at getting that accurate, because it's nighttime, we're drowsy, our memory isn't the best, and we're not probably sitting there writing down exactly when we woke and when we fell back to sleep again. So often our self-report or our understanding of what the problem is not entirely correct. So keeping a diary or a journal will really help you know whether any change is happening. Because you might find that 6 weeks later you've actually made some really good changes, but you kind of look back and you're not really sure, you didn't notice it along the way, so you might think that nothing has changed. So keep a diary, including of how was your sleep last night, when did you wake, how long do you think you were awake for? But also things like, what time did you go to bed, what time did you get up in the morning, exactly what strategies did you do? Were there any extraneous circumstances that day that might have contributed to? So really keeping tabs on what you're doing and what's happening. So that's a really key point to take away today. Identify all the causes and all the contributing factors, as I mentioned just before, and address each one of them. And this might be around brainstorming and problem solving with someone close to you. And as I just mentioned before, keep a sleep diary to track the changes over time. Sleep routine. Prepare for bed. Most people tend to, when it's bedtime, that's when you go and get changed and you clean your teeth and you wash your face and you do the dishes. And when you're ready to go to bed, you should just be ready to go to bed. So really think of your sleep routine as starting 2 hours before you will be going to sleep. Get into your pajamas, clean your teeth long before you need to go to bed. Do any of the things you need to do around the house long before you go to bed. Ideally, in the short time before bed, avoid eating, avoid drinking, avoid exercise. You want to be calm, you want to be resting, you want to be ready to sleep. This is where the ultradian rhythms, those 90-minute sleep cycles, come in. When we have these 90-minute dips where we do feel a little more tired and other times when we feel a bit more alert, the ideal time to go to bed is when you're noticing a dip. So if you're ready to go to bed, you can catch the sleep wave. You can say, yep, I'm noticing those sleep signals. My body's telling me I'm drowsy. My eyes are sort of closing, and I'm not really paying attention to the television anymore. It's time to go to bed. That's when you need to go to bed. So catch that sleep wave cycle. And if you're already and prepared to go to bed, it should be no problem. It should be a matter of just getting up and shuffling into the room next door. But that's the ideal. So that's a lot of people don't live that way, so it might be a change in your routine, but that's a really good place to start. Okay, engage in really good sleep habits. Now, this is something that people struggle with. If you do wake in the middle of the night, the recommendations are that you shouldn't lie there for more than 20 minutes if you're not getting to sleep. Because some people lie there for hours, and when you're in a dark room and it's night time and there's nothing else to think about or focus your attention on, this is where our brains tend to kick in with all the worries we have, with all the stresses we have, and also because we're tired, we don't tend to engage with them in a very constructive way. We tend to sort of spin around and around, and you all know that at night time things always seem a lot bigger and worse than they are during the daytime. So lying there feeling frustrated, worrying about your sleep, worrying about everything else, is not going to help. So if you don't go back to sleep for about 20 minutes, the recommendation is get up and get out of bed as well. Because then the bedroom is about sleep, and if you're not sleeping, you need to leave the bedroom. Now, this is really hard, having this talk at the beginning of winter, yeah. Telling people to get up and out of bed, your nice little cozy bed. So you might need to, again, you know, adapt to that. Make sure you've got some slippers and a really warm jacket or blanket or something so that you can immediately be warm when you get out of bed. Make sure that the heating is ready to go. So if you go into another room, that the heating is on or that it's ready to be turned on, or that there's a hot water bottle or a Wheatie that you can heat up so that you're not cold, because it's really hard in the middle of winter getting out of bed, isn't it? And have a plan. So if you are going to get up out of bed in the middle of the night, what are you going to do? Again, you don't want to be eating big meals, drinking hot cups of tea that you might then need to wake up and go to the loo, you know, an hour later for. You want to be doing something that's really relaxing, that's just going to assist in going back to sleep. And again, when you catch that sleepiness, that ultradian rhythm, when you notice that your body is sleepy and that you're ready for sleep, just go straight back to the bedroom and try and get to sleep again. 20 minutes later, if you're still awake, unfortunately, the recommendations are get up again and go out of the bedroom. So this is a tough one, and a lot of people don't like doing it, but if you're really, really wanting to make a concerted effort, give it a go. Make it work. Give it 4 to 6 weeks. What can it hurt? You know, give it a try. Another really important part of the circadian rhythm, that 24-hour clock, is the time we wake up in the morning. Ideally, we want to go to bed at around the same time and get up at around the same time every day. Those help set our circadian rhythm. So our body says, okay, this is up time, and we know that 16 hours later, it's time to go to bed again. So if you're getting up at 10 o'clock one morning and 6 o'clock the next morning, your body doesn't know what it wants to do. So a lot of people try and get to bed at the same time, and that's good. But again, what, you know, I'd say just, you know, half an hour here or there doesn't really matter. Catch the sleep wave if you have trouble getting to sleep. But getting up at the same time every morning is really, really important. Some people want to lie in on the weekends. What do you do about that? If you really want to lie in, you know, it's entirely, again, all of this is your choice and what you want to do and how strict you want to be on yourself. An extra hour for one day of the week is not going to be the end of the world for your sleep. And give your, if it, you know, if it brings you pleasure and it's really nice to do that, then you want to factor that into, you know, what's feeding you and your life in enriching ways versus what's draining it. So you don't need to be too strict on all of these things. Some variation is fine, but ideally keeping that wake time. If you're getting up at 7:30 every day during the week, try and get up around that time on the weekend as well. The other thing is to, again, in the ideal world, is to avoid daytime napping, because it can throw your circadian rhythm and your sleep-wake cycle. However, obviously, if people are unwell, are going through treatment regimes, are generally low on energy, then napping might be exactly what you do need to do. So if that's the case for you, the recommendations are to nap prior to 3 p.m. if possible, and to try and keep naps to a short time, maybe of 30 minutes or so, and to try and nap on a regular basis. So that, you know, again, it's part of creating a routine, so your body starts to know what the routine is and your body will start to follow that routine. But of course, everyone is a bit different here, so particularly with people who have gone through or are going through treatment, you might need to adapt that to your own circumstances. But as I say, try and make it a regular and routine thing if you can. Talk to your doctors if you need about what might be ideal and what might be good for you at that point in time. Okay. Sleep associations. So I've mentioned these before in terms of the bedroom should really be about sleep and good quality sleep. So avoid non-sleep activities in the bedroom. So television's the big thing, or radio. People sort of say, well, I like having the radio on because it kind of, you know, it kind of helps get me to sleep. And I think there really is a bit of a, it's hard to know what the line is, you know, where to draw the line here. For some people, they go to bed and they read a book for 15 minutes, or they listen to the radio for 15 minutes. And it really does help relax them and settle them in and keep the, you know, mind on something that's kind of neutral and is good for you. And if that's working for you, I'd say that's fine. However, if you're sitting there popping on a DVD, a new movie at 11 at night, and you're trying to stay up to watch the end of the movie, or, you know, that's not going to help. If you're listening to a really engaging talkback show and it's, you know, it's a bit too engaging, again, that might not be helpful for you. Or if it's a page turner of a book and you just can't put it down, maybe read that in the morning, or don't start it at night time. So just use your judgment there, and be, again, be sort of just sensible in what does work for you and what doesn't work for you. But ideally, the bed and the bedroom should be about sleep. Avoid sleeping or napping in other places. Again, consistency, routine, really helpful. Make a ritual and routine around preparing for bed. So if you really want to make good changes to your sleep, this is like, it's like changing your diet to lose weight on a permanent basis. You have to make a lifestyle commitment and change to doing things differently. So really work out, if you're going to start getting to ready for bed 2 hours before bed, what else is going to need to change there? What do you need to let go of or do at another time or in a different way? So really try and integrate a completely new routine into your life to make this work. Worry control. This is a really big thing that people talk about. It's very hard to control our minds, particularly at night time and particularly when we're tired, unfortunately. A lot of people say that they can't sleep because their mind is just, it suddenly becomes hyper alert as soon as you lie down. And that is because you're kind of giving your brain space to process. During the day, there's an awful lot of distractions that keep us focused on tasks. And if you're going through a very tumultuous or big time in your life, your brain needs to process, it needs to catch up, it needs to think things through, it needs to problem solve. Our brain's job is to be active, you know, to work things through, you know. And so if you're worrying at night time, your brain's actually doing its job. It's just that it's doing it at a time of the day that's really not helpful for you. So there are all sorts of ways that you need to look at how to control the brain activity and the types of and times that you worry, so that you're not worrying when you're trying to get to sleep. So try and engage in activities that slow down your thinking. So watch television that's not too engaging, read a book, etc. But there are some tricks, for example, to try and catch and stop unwanted thoughts. So earlier on we were talking about thoughts that are unrealistic or thoughts that are unhelpful. Yet then you might have two or three that are real sort of frequent flyers in your mind. Get to know them, and when you notice yourself thinking again about the same things, catch that thought and tell yourself, I don't need to be having that. You know, there are other things to be focusing on. There are different ways of looking at the situation, and replace them. You know, change the thought. We actually have some control over what we think. So the more you become in tune with the way you think, the more control you can have. Worrying is sometimes very productive. It helps us problem solve and process, as I mentioned. Other times it's stuff that we've been and gone through before and things that we can't problem solve, and so worrying is actually unproductive. So there's productive worry and there's unproductive worry. So if you're worrying excessively at night, or your brain is simply processing things on high alert, it means that maybe there hasn't been enough time during the day for your brain to do all of that it needs to do. So some suggestions are to make a worry time. 3 o'clock in the afternoon, sit down with a pen and paper and worry. It's actually really hard to worry on command. But let me tell you, try it. Try it, because you will run out of worries. There are only so many worries that you have. And once you start to write them down, your list will come to an end at some point. Your list will come to an end. So we can worry endlessly for hours and hours and hours and hours. But if we actually give us a time to worry, and we put them down on paper and we actively think about and try and problem solve and worry about those things, eventually you realise in a fairly short period of time you've done all the worrying you can. And if there are ways to solve your problems or things to do, it's a lot more productive to do that during the daytime with a pen and paper than trying to figure it all out at night time, when you'll probably forget all the solutions that you came up with by the next morning. So have a worry time, half an hour. 15 minutes will probably be sufficient, but give it half an hour if you want. Make it a really productive worry time. And then when you're going to sleep, your mind will probably, because it does this, will go back to the same old worries again, and it will try and regurgitate and rethink. And you just, that's when you say, you know, I've been there, I've done that, we've already looked at that. And if it's something new, thank you, brain, but we'll do that tomorrow afternoon. Yeah? So we've got tomorrow's worry time, and I can come back to that then. So it's about teaching your brain some boundaries, giving it some, some rules. So catch your thoughts, defer them to the worry time, write or list down your worries, and differentiate between worries you can solve. Yes, those are really good to focus on at times. If it's the same old worry that you can't solve, there's no point in letting yourself getting caught up in that loop. And if you're finding you are getting caught up in that loop, you really need to find ways to you know, break that, be a bit of a circuit breaker to stop that. And that might be focusing on other things entirely. Challenge or replace unhelpful thoughts. So here are some examples of what you could say to yourself if you're finding that you're not getting to sleep and you're frustrated. So you could say to yourself, well, peaceful rest is as good as sleep. If you're lying there in bed and you're trying to get to sleep and you're frustrated about that, that's not going to help. But just simply lying in bed and resting is good. You're helping do what you're meant to do when you're sleeping. So even though you're awake, you're still doing what you're meant to be doing. So remind yourself that. Peaceful rest is great. It's really good. Sleep problems are normal. You know, that it's a common part of life. It's not the end of the world. It might feel like it, and I don't want to minimise the problems associated with it. But sometimes it can be helpful to remind yourself that it's okay. And it's okay if I don't get to sleep straight away. You might be one of those people that just takes an hour every night to get to sleep. And again, you have a choice here. You can either get really frustrated about that or fight that, you know, and struggle with it, or you can just accept that it's going to take me an hour to get to bed, so I'm not going to get frustrated after 10 minutes. I'm not going to get frustrated after 30 minutes because I know it takes about an hour to get to bed. So again, be realistic and tell yourself, if you're finding your thoughts are going down the negative track, that it's okay, I will get to sleep in the end. Every night I do get to sleep in the end, so I'll just let it be. So replace and challenge the unhelpful ones. For example, you could say to yourself, the worst thing is that I'll be tired and grumpy, and it's not the end of the world. You know, it might feel like it, but it isn't. You know, you can tell yourself these things, and it can be helpful just to shift those cognitions, and it won't last forever. Sometimes for some people it does feel like it lasts forever. Distraction. And again, this is where it's the balance between distracting your mind off the worries and not distracting your mind into areas that are actually going to stimulate you too much. So sometimes it can just be as simple as repeating a word or a mantra to yourself. But it might be just repeating the word relax, or it might be a positive affirmation or something that you'd like to say about, you know, a loved one. Focusing on your breathing is a wonderful tool. There's a lot of breathing that's done while exercising, in yoga, in meditation, mindfulness practice. And why is breathing so good? Because it's the one thing that is always with us. Wherever we are, we're breathing. And so you can always you can always ground yourself, you can always focus your mind on your breath, wherever you are. And if you're focusing on your breath, breathing in and breathing out, one, again, we can control our breathing. A bit like our thoughts, most of the time they just happen. But we can exert our control over it. So breathing is a really wonderful way of actually slowing things down, breathing more slowly, breathing more gently, and focusing on it so that we're kind of helping block out all that, the useless worry, the worry that isn't helpful. Some people conjure up mental imagery, so some people are much better at having creating mental images in their minds than others. Some people really struggle to do it, but some people find it really nice. So an imagery that you might like to try, for example, is a very simple one, is an image of a lovely window with some sort of sheer material, and the material's just gently blowing in and out in the breeze, you know. You might have an imagery yourself of you know, trees and in the wind, waves on the beach. It might be a place that you just simply have loved and been to on a holiday, or a place that's very meaningful for you. You might conjure up an image of someone's face, for example. You might create a static image, or you might create an image that's moving. You might walk through a field or along a beach, or you know, through a house that you loved, you know, as a child. You can really just be creative in terms of what kind of things might be nice for you to focus on. This is instead of, you know, focusing on the thoughts and the worries. Some people find that white noise can be quite helpful, again, just having a little bit of a background noise, particularly if you've got noisy neighbours or kids or the other things that actually are going to disrupt your sleep. And you can just, you know, you can get that by putting a radio on and tuning it to not to a station, but to, you know, to between stations, and you'll just get white noise. Regular meditation, regular yoga, regular exercise somehow seem to be very helpful at managing mental activity. Again, I think it comes back to it's about a practice around breathing and around centering ourselves in our bodies. So if you have time to do something like that, I'd strongly encourage that. Physical and mental relaxation are very, very important, as I really just touched on before. So deep breathing. When we're stressed and when we're anxious and when we're worried, we tend to breathe very shallowly. So we don't get very good quality oxygen. And you know, we're very busy sort of breathing in and out like that. If we slow it down, the quality of our breathing is greatly improved, and that helps slow down our mind too. There are techniques of progressive muscle relaxation where you might go through different muscle groups of your body one at a time, where you tense them for a little bit and then you relax. And we know that when you tense your muscles before relaxing, you obtain a deeper relaxation. So some people lie in bed and they work their way through different muscle groups of their body, just gently tensing for about 5 or 10 seconds and then relaxing. So, you know, you start with your toes, your feet, you know, your calves, your thighs, your buttocks, your torso, your stomach, you know, your back muscles, and you might move a little bit to get a bit of tension and then just gently relax. Some people use tapes that actually talk them through different relaxation strategies. And I think sometimes that's easier than trying to do these on your own at night time. But you've got to make sure that it's not like on a CD that repeats or anything that eventually turns off, because ideally you fall asleep during one of these tapes and then it turns itself off. Positive imagery, we spoke about that, you know, the window as an example. Other things to physically and mentally relax before bed, you know, have a hot shower, have a bath. Lie on a couch, don't run around, do things, you know, literally get your body and mind into a relaxed place before bed would be ideal. Exercise, I've already mentioned this a little bit. It really does improve mood. We know it's been studied. So if someone is low in mood, flat in mood, etc., then exercise, regular exercise, is fantastic. It also is known to help with side effects of treatment and to help with maintaining a good sleep cycle. And that's also in cancer populations that this research has been done. So exercise can be anything. It does not have to be running marathons or going to the gym or doing anything like that. A lot of these studies were done simply with walking short distances. So if you're physically able to manage that, you know, a short walk each day is fantastic. It really does. You know, it's been shown to help people sleep when, you know, they take a group of people who are going through treatment and some walk and some don't, and it has a significant difference. So don't underestimate the very simple things you can do with some gentle exercise. Do try to avoid it immediately before bedtime. Diet. Balanced and healthy diet. Avoid eating meals just prior to bed. Some foods assist in sleep. Milk and bananas are the two that stand out for me. They've got something in them, tryptophan I think it's called, that actually does make us a little sleepy. But it's not like a banana is going to make you go to sleep. You know. But these, again, little small things. If you're going to drink something, maybe try milk. You know, if you're going to eat something, maybe try a banana. Drink sufficient fluids, but obviously, again, this is partly around regulating temperature, but also, you know, some people in terms of needing to go to the loo in the middle of the night, you know, there's a balance between having enough fluid so that you don't overheat and not drinking too much so you don't need to be woken by going to the loo. Avoid alcohol, we've already mentioned, and avoid any stimulants. Sleep medications, I think this might be my final slide, but it's a really important one. Sleep medications can be very helpful. Again, they can be a bit of a circuit breaker for people. So some people are very anti-medications, and that's okay if that's you as well. Some people are very pro-medications, and you kind of want to be somewhere in the middle. You don't want the medications to be your cure, because you really want to find natural ways of managing your sleep in an ongoing manner. However, sleep medications can be really fantastic, and while I've said here that they're band-aids, they're not a cure. Band-aids are fantastic, you know, we use band-aids for a reason. They help heal. And so in a similar way, a short-term or you know, appropriate medication might be exactly what you need to change the cycle of your sleep to allow you to get some good sleep so that you can actually then implement the things you need to do to sustain that over time. So, you know, it might be something to think about. What I really do recommend is that you only take medications under the guidance of a doctor. There are a range of different medications that can help with sleep. Some really are only short term, they should only be used for short term use, and so by that I mean about 2 weeks and no longer, because they have the strong potential for addiction or actually then causing the very problems that they're very good at helping to begin with. There are other medications that can help with sleep. For example, many antidepressant medications have a very good effect on sleep as well. So even if you're not depressed, they can be very helpful if you do have a sleep problem. So again, and they often have slightly less and different side effects, such that you can take them in a slightly more continuing way. But talk with your doctor if that's of interest to you, and make sure that you get really clear advice on what to take, when to take it, and what you need to do when you come off that medication as well. And I think... Oh, a couple of take-home messages. So sleep problems are treatable. They are difficult, but as I said, there's a way of going about treating sleep problems, and I hope that some of those messages you'll take home with you today. Seek professional advice if you need. Doctors are there. They're really good at the medication assistance. Talk through some options with your doctor if you want. As a psychologist, I work in a therapy capacity, in a counselling capacity all the time with people, sleep comes up regularly. And, you know, I am trained, and most psychologists are trained to help with sleep problems. There are some sleep schools, there are some specialists in sleep, so, you know, there are people around you can go to also try and get some help. The other thing, actually, I haven't mentioned is sleep apnea. There are some medical causes of sleep problems, and so again, you know, that's where you stop breathing for a minute or so and then sort of wake up gulping for breath. And you might want to check yourself out in those ways to make sure that you don't actually have an underlying medical condition that's causing your sleep problem. Identify all the possible contributing factors, develop a plan, practice and trial it, and commit to the 4 to 6 weeks. The longer the sleep problem, the longer it will take for new habits to be established, but it is possible. And I think that might be my last slide, but I wish you all the very best of luck with your sleep problems, and hope that today has been a little helpful in giving you some ideas of where to start.
Thanks, Justine. Have you got any questions at all for Justine? Any general questions about sleep?
When you talk about medication, I'm assuming you're talking about prescribed medication, or is this
yes.
also for natural?
Sorry, I should have clarified. Yes, I was referring to prescribed medications. There are, I know people, some people go to naturopaths who give more sort of herbal medicines, and that they're homeopathic medications, and I'm not at all an expert on those, but I have met and know people who really think that those things can be very helpful. Acupuncture is meant to be quite helpful with sleep problems. So, again, I'm not at all an expert on any of these things, but I think they're well worth looking into and researching and possibly, you know, trialing for yourself. Yeah, thank you for clarifying that.
Another thing too, I have these restless legs, not every night.
Yeah.
And when I have these restless legs and whatever, I just...
Yeah. I think if you struggle with that, I'd recommend going to your GP and having a conversation about it, because it is a known syndrome, and not being a medical doctor, I only know a little bit of what I've read about it, but I think if, you know, a GP would be a first person, because there might be something you can do about that, because again, it's one of many contributing factors, so give that a go.
We could just keep our questions fairly general in nature.
Can I just ask, if you feel tired during the latter part of the day, should you just fight that, knowing that if you succumb and have a nap, then it reacts in a not a good way, to sleep during the night?
That is the recommendation. As I said, if you really need to nap before 3 o'clock, and try and keep it short. Unfortunately, sometimes with some of these, you know, changes that you implement, you have to go through a bit of grief to get the benefit. And I would recommend that, resisting, go to bed at a regular time and get up at a regular time. And you might find that for a couple of days you feel really bad because you're not getting a nap that you might normally have got. But I think ideally that would be the way to go. Yeah, part of it might be. Anyone else?
If you just fall asleep at, say, 7 o'clock in the evening and just nod off your pen in the bed when you wake up, good as gold at 10 o'clock.
It's
hard to avoid.
So the question was, you know, if you have a sort of a 10-minute mini nap at 7 in the evening, is it a problem? Again, look, I think 10 minutes is actually not a lot of time. So I don't think a 10-minute nap is going to hugely disrupt your full night's sleep. So if you find that you're just having a little mini nap every now and again, I wouldn't worry about it too much.
It's just a bad time.
But if it, maybe make sure that it is only 10 minutes.
If it
starts getting a little longer, or you think that it might be related to not getting to sleep, then maybe try and not have that nap. But I think it's okay. It's all right. Any other questions? Sorry.
No more questions? Well, Justine, we really want to thank you very much for coming along. I think it was a really practical, informative talk. So a little something.
Thank you very much. That's lovely.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. You can subscribe to Brecan Podcasts or browse existing podcasts by visiting www.brecan.org.au.